This is the Rams Review Podcast. Discussions, insights, interviews, and analysis. All passion, all Derby County. Hello everybody, just a quick message to say this episode actually was recorded nearly an entire year ago and we've just not had the chance or opportunity to put it out yet, so if any of the content is a little bit outdated we apologise, but we think it's a very good interview, it's worth getting out there, hope you enjoy it, speak to you soon. Before we get back to the episode, we wanted to announce new for this season, we've decided to sign up to Patreon. We feel this is the best way to allow fans of the podcast and all we do on our social medias and website to show us support if they wish. All money generated will go back into the podcast to try and make things even better. We've decided to launch three tiers. Basic support for £1 a month, just your way of saying a little thank you. Supporter at £3 a month, this is a bit more of a thank you. And you'll also get a chance to join our private social media group with a few more perks on the way. And finally, super supporter. £4.50. This is a tier where you'll get automatically entered into all giveaways and get special promo codes from our growing partners. You'll also, if you want, be able to have more of a say on actual episodes and interviews, etc. And of course, get to meet us and see how things work behind the scenes here at Rams Review. As the Patreon grows, the rewards will grow and all episodes will always remain free. Sign up now at patreon.com, Rams Review Podcast. Thank you very much.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Rams Review Podcast. We're back with a Rams Review Meets episode, and we're meeting with one of the most charismatic managers of the past 20 years, former Derby County manager and Hull City manager, as well as Barrow, Southend, and several other clubs. It's the legendary Phil Brown. Phil, welcome to the podcast. Thank you for taking the time to chat with me today.
No, Corey, it's a pleasure. It really is. I've been looking forward to it. Sometimes you sit back and you think about your career, and other times it's prompted. In this stage, it's going to be prompted by you guys, I'm sure.
So, first thing, how are you doing? You left Barrow in the summer. What's it like? We're now, three months into this accelerated football season. What's it like for you with having a break from the game for the first time in a while?
It's I always miss it, Corey. I've got to say it, it's in my blood. How it got in my blood can only be, I suppose, explained by my parents more than anything else. But I was introduced to the world of football by my dad at Newcastle United and my mother at Sunderland. So we had a split in the family from day one, which way do I go, black and white or red and white? I eventually plumped for Sunderland, and one of my first cup runs, if you like, was the FA Cup 1973, where we actually beat Leeds in the final. I didn't actually get to the final, but I watched Sunderland beat Man City on the way. I watched them beat Arsenal on the way. I just fell in love with the club. And consequently, because of that love for Sunderland, it became a love for football. And I didn't know I was ever going to play it. I had no idea when I was playing Sunday League football, I had no idea I was going to become a professional footballer. Did I want to? Absolutely. I think it was every boy's dream, but it was my mother's dream. My father's dream was to make sure I got a trade. It was the Northeast mentality, make sure you've got a trade. And my trade was as an electrician. When I left school, I joined a company called Pyrotechnics, and I became a qualified electrician by the time I was 20. And on the same day, I got the indenture forms to become an electrician. I became a professional footballer on the same day. So I can only class myself as one of the lucky guys. There must be millions out there with, sob stories and sad stories, shall we say. But I was one of the lucky ones. And once I got my way into the realms of a professional football club, Hartlepool United it was, and got into that changing room atmosphere and mentality, it was just absolutely something I dreamed about, I'd die for. And I made sure that I was always going to be there for a long time. And fortunately, 43 years later, I'm still going into changing rooms and mixing with boys my age that, you know, back in the day. And it's just something you can't explain to the outsider, you know.
I mean, so when you walk into the dressing room at Hartlepool United, this obviously had been a dream, but you didn't think it was going to happen. And you sign on as a professional. Must have been an incredibly proud moment for you and your family. But was your mentality going in there, I'm in this dressing room now, and I want to make sure that I'm always in a dressing room like this, so you're going to work harder and not rest on your laurels?
I don't think, you know, it's something that people have often said to me, did you work harder? No, I had an upbringing where my parents were concerned that hard work was rewarded, you know, so it wasn't a case of changing anything. I became a footballer because of probably my hard work as an electrician, as a person. Whatever I decided to lend my hand to, I put everything into it. I never quit. I never pulled out of anything. I always challenged things. I always met them head on and went for them, you know. And when I was offered this, I got a 5-year deal when I was, you know, 20 year old. And I wasn't going to sit back on 5 years, not a chance. This was the start. This was the beginning of a journey. Not a career. I didn't know where it was going to take me. I didn't think I was good enough. If truth be known, Corey, I honestly didn't think I was good enough in them days, but somebody else did. And I was always going to reward or repay that with endeavour, with desire, with commitment, and hard work just was one of the prerequisites of being a Brown. And fortunately, it's carried me right through until this day. But you learn from mistakes, you learn from your experiences. And the very first experience that I learned from was I became the shop steward of the changing room at Hartlepool United only because I was the captain. Now, I was never in a million years questioning why a manager had decided to give a 22-year-old guy the captaincy when there was players sitting around me that had vast experience at a higher level and greater careers than I'd ever had or I ever dreamed of. But somebody trusted me with the captaincy. So therefore, when I look back, and I didn't analyse or overanalyze it, I just looked back and I just thought, well, I must have been loud. I must have had something to say and people must have wanted to listen to it. And fortunately for me, it carried me right through my career as a captain and then onto coaching and management.
And so you had nearly a 20-year playing career, distinguished playing career for 4 clubs, Hartlepool, Halifax, Bolton Wanderers, and Blackpool, who my dad supports.
Okay.
What are some of the best memories of you playing?
The best memories are obviously the winning memories, but they're not necessarily the ones that you learn from, you know. The times where you're sometimes going through the worst part of your career, your worst moments, you know, a losing run, and you're still stepping up to the plate, you're still digging in, you're still hanging in there, you know, and looking around the changing room and wondering what other guys were thinking, what other people were thinking and feeling, more importantly, and were they quitters, were they in it for the long haul? All of them things, I think you can look back fondly on me personally and look around them changing room and always know that when you win a winning changing room, everybody says, yeah, you always remember them winning change. Of course you do. You remember the people around you that were on the same page as you, on the same wavelength as you. But also the guys that were in the trenches with you at Hartlepool United. Sometimes, you know, in the early stages of my career at Hartlepool, we were applying for re-election, which was the game plan in them days. You know, it was the old fourth division. And when you finished at a certain place in the league, you had to apply for re-election. That happened a couple of times in the early stages of my career, but I didn't want any of that. You know, I wanted to surround myself with better players, better mentality. And I fortunately got the opportunity to when I got my first move to Halifax. And then I used that as a stepping stone for bigger things and better things. And when I stayed at Halifax for 2 or 3 years, surrounded again by very good players, very good professionals. But I got my move to Bolton Wanderers when I was 27 year old. And that's when I thought my career started in earnest, shall we say. And we played at Wembley. We had a couple of great cup runs where we beat Arsenal, we beat Liverpool, we beat Everton, we beat Aston Villa. You know, we had some great scalps in some tremendous cup runs under Bruce Rioch. Them were the fond memories. Them were the ones where you're looking at guys that have played at the highest level all their careers, and you're on the same stage as them, and you're coming away with the spoils. You know, you're winning the game. They're the fond memories. They're the ones that you remember probably most. You know, the fact that you go to Anfield and beat Liverpool 2-0. It is something that was just like it's yesterday, you know. You go to Arsenal, the old Highbury, and you beat them 3-1. And it's like yesterday. I'm recalling it as if it was yesterday. And nicely enough, I mean, fortunately enough, you get a chance to meet some of them, the players, later on when I was managing at Hull City. I signed Ray Parlour at the end of his career. And I reminded Ray that we had beat him at, you know, at Highbury in a cup game, and he can't remember that. but that's the way it is, you know. They're the ones that you remember. But more importantly, I think it's the people and the characters that you remember more than anything. And then obviously the learning curve was the managers that you bump into. You know, as I've mentioned, big influences in my coaching and my management career. For different reasons. You know, one was a disciplinarian, strict disciplinarian, and I used some of that. But the other one, Sam Allardyce, I'm making reference to, was a guy that I respect massively and learned an awful lot from, probably more than anybody else in the game, and took whatever he gave, little snippets of classic information, whatever he gave me, I took with me to my managerial career. So, you know, in a long-winded answer, the highlights are meeting great people more than anything else. But the great memories of beating Liverpool and Arsenal on their home stadiums.
At what point in your career, Phil, did you think about becoming a manager? Was it towards the end part, or did you always kind of know 5 or 6 years into your career that management and coaching is something you wanted to go into?
No, I always ran something concurrently with the game of football. I felt as if there was a lot of spare time, enough time for to get into trouble, no doubt about it. You know, you were occupied for 2 hours a day. And if you spent the rest of the day in a bar or in a bookmaker's or whatever, you go down the wrong road. I made sure I kept myself occupied. I had an electrical business, which I run with my brother-in-law, and that was running right the way through, probably from 22 till about 28. I then went into restaurants and bars and nightclubs in that trade, and I had that for 5 or 6 years. But it was the meeting of Bruce Rioch and a very stern word from him about my activity off the field of play. You know, I was running all these businesses and not spending enough time, in his mind, not spending enough time with football. And I saying, well, what do you want me to do? He said, I want you to eat, sleep, drink, think, and everything. Breathe football. And this game can't do without you. These were the words coming out of Bruce Rioch. This game can't do without you. Go and do your coaching badges. Go and do your management badges. Make sure that when you're ready at 35, 36, whatever time you retire, make sure you're ready to walk into that line of football, because the way he said it was a great sales pitch. Football needs you, is what he said to me. And for somebody to believe that about you, I couldn't not think any different. He's believing that about me. He must see something in me. And that started me off on my coaching career. And I did the certificate of applied management when I was 32, 33 year old. And I fortunately, Corey, and I'll emphasize this, and yes, the game is moving that way. I fortunately played right the way until I was 38 year old, which was testimony to the hard work that I used to put in, testimony to a lot of luck, testimony to the fitness levels that I used to pride myself with. But then, having retired at Blackpool and Sam Allardyce was in charge, fortunately got offered a job as first team coach, and it was seamless. It was the transition from player to club. Player to player coach to coach, coach to manager. It just appeared seamless for the next 10 years and ended up where I've ended up, actually.
How difficult was it to be a player manager, player coach at Blackpool towards the end of your career? Was it, because I always felt like it, because you see the instances very rarely these days, but you used to see it a few years ago, right? And it always seemed very weird because you'd be playing in the team that you're helping to select, and that could potentially cause rifts, I would assume, within the dressing room. Like, who the hell is Phil Brown? Why is he not picking me in the team? I was in his spot last week and whatever. How did you manage those two aspects?
It's a good question, because it's a difficult answer. It's one of the most difficult things that you have to do. You have one foot in each camp. You know, you have a foot in the change room and you have a foot in the coach's room. And you have to be trusted in both. You have to have the dignity and the honesty and the trust of the players not to relate any kind of information back to the management that they don't want you to. So you have to pick and choose. Of course you do. But then there's things that do come out that are important that the manager needs to know. So you have to make sure that you pick the right moments, pick the right subjects, as it were, that can be transient, you know, can be in both changing rooms, as it were, or both environments, shall I say. And I always remember an incident with Andy Morrison. Andy Morrison, who played, you know, football for Man City and Plymouth, and he was at Blackpool, and he was a leader. He was a strong character, a real strong character, centre-half, and a real hard man off the field of play and on the field of play. And Andy was in the change room, and I became player coach. And I dug him out after a game in front of everybody. It wasn't private. It was in front of everybody. And he waited for his moment, and he asked, why did I do that? And I felt as if I needed to, because the team needed to benefit from him being a better person or a better player. Well, lo and behold, I'm not belying anybody's confidence, you see. And lo and behold, probably 22 years later, I had a telephone call with Andy Morrison, who's gone into coaching, gone into management. And the respect that he showed me from that moment onwards, that changed his life, more or less, changed his whole outlook on coaching, changed his whole outlook on how to handle people by being honest, by being upfront, by being brutal at times. But you'll never get anywhere in the game unless you do something like that. And Jock, God love him. You know, I wish him all the best. You know, I hope he's really successful in management or whatever he chooses to do. But for that to come out to him 20 odd years later was proof that whatever I was doing, I was doing honestly. I was doing genuinely. And you have to be brutal sometimes in a change room to get the best out of players.
Is sometimes that management always, sometimes it's a science and sometimes it's an art. And is that one of the arts of management and coaching when you're leading a team and just saying, I feel it here that these players need a rollicking, or these players need an arm around them, or, you know, we've had a tough defeat and the group's low and I need to put them on. Is that just something that you don't necessarily set out to do, but you just get the sense that this is the way this group needs to be treated at this specific time?
Well, again, if you stay with the same subject and the same person, after I'd done what I'd done in front of everybody, I walked into the coach's room and I sat down and literally physically slumped into the chair, exhausted with what I'd actually done. And Sam followed me in, Sam Allardyce followed me in, and he looked at me and said, what's your problem? What's your issue? And I said, I can't believe I've just done that to a fellow player or fellow professional. And I'll not go any further with, you know, to what extent it went to, but I said, I just can't believe. He said, how does it feel? He said, deep down in the pit of your stomach, how does it feel? Does it feel right or does it feel wrong? And it felt right. And he said, then it's right. End of story. You've been honest. You've been true to yourself. You've been honest. And I've always said that as a young coach or a coach talking to young coaches, anybody asks a bit of advice, I always say, be honest, be true to yourself. And that is the best piece of advice I can give to anybody. And when Sam had said this, I felt better. I felt as if I'd done it for the benefit of the team and the group. And obviously 20 years later, it actually helped the player no end. So you always got to question what you're doing and why you're doing it. But if it's for the benefit of everybody, and obviously we're in a team environment, if it's a benefit for everybody, then it's got to be right.
And when you retired, you were kind of out of the game for about 9 years. You had a caretaker spell at Bolton Wanderers before you took the Derby job full time. What happened in those intervening years? Was it just a break from football and focusing on family and some other things?
No, I was involved in football. I didn't really break away from the game. I didn't try management until The right one came along. I was assistant manager with Colin Todd at Bolton Wanderers straight after Blackpool. And then a quirk of fate, if you like, a strange quirk of fate, Sam Allardyce then became manager of Bolton Wanderers and I was his assistant. So we stayed closely linked to Sam, to the game, and eventually Bolton Wanderers qualified for the Premier League. So I became, you know, an assistant manager for about 5 or 6 years, maybe even 7 years. And that was me serving my full apprenticeship in terms of going into management. I had, when Sam walked into the job at Bolton, I was Colin Todd's assistant and we had worked together before. And the first thing Sam said was, I know you applied for the job. I know you went for the job. Can you work as a number two until the best number one position becomes available? In which case, if you can, stay here with me and we'll work together towards getting this club into the Premier League. We agreed that we would do that. We did. We got the club into the Premier League. And then I applied for three jobs. Burnley and Steve Cottrell got the job. West Bromwich Albion and Brian Robson got the job. And my third application, and these were all backed up by Sam. These were all referenced by Sam Allardyce, you know, as me, you know, my main reference, main referee. And my third one was Derby County and I got the job. So that was an apprenticeship well served, if you ask me.
What attracted you to apply for the Derby County job?
Well, if you reference Burnley, West Bromwich Albion and Derby County, all three of them were, at that time, championship clubs with potential, I thought, championship clubs with ambition, championship clubs that had a great history. And Derby being probably the pinnacle of them three, and that's no disrespect to Burnley or West Bromwich Albion. But Derby had a history in Europe. Derby had a history of Brian Clough and great days and massive club, massive following. And when they, you know, when the chance came along, don't get me wrong, if I'd have finished first ahead of Steve Cottrell at Burnley, I would have been Burnley manager. If I'd have finished first ahead of Brian Robson, I'd have been West Bromwich Albion manager. So that twist of fate, if you like, gave me the opportunity, first opportunity in management at Derby County. And unfortunately, only lasted 8 months. But I could go into a lot of things, you know, but it was just a very poorly run club at the time, and I didn't see any of this because of my inexperience. It was a very poorly run club, highlighted by the fact that when I got relieved of my duties, and Derby fans will probably tell you that I deserved to because of results, fair enough. But you know, when three distinguished, shall we say, members of the board then get jailed, three jailed after I got the sack, I would hope that the true Derby County fan would look back and go, wow, that was a baptism of fire for a young manager, if I've ever heard it. And if they did and realised that, you know, cut me some slack, it was my apprenticeship being served, et cetera, unfortunately, at the risk of losing my job, I would have still took the Derby County job all day long, even if I'd known in hindsight that three players, three management, were going to get jailed. I would have still took the Derby job because it's a massive club and a great opportunity.
So you didn't realize when you went for the job how the shenanigans that were going on behind the scenes.
I had no idea how corrupt it was. I had an idea that football was corrupt in various guises from the highest level, if you like, in where UEFA were concerned. But whenever corruption came my way, the doors were closed. There was not a chance of me entertaining anything like that. And I would hope and pray that, you know, the fact that I wasn't questioned by police after my sacking at Derby County, I would hope and pray that people would have realised that when the three members of the Derby board got jailed and I was nowhere near that, they would understand fully that I had nothing to do with it, you know. And I was just trying, as a young manager, trying to get a team to win a game of football. And it was difficult enough without that going on in the background, if truth be known. But without that, and I've said this many a time, without that baptism of fire, I wouldn't have done any of what I've done since then. It was an absolute sound footing in terms of learning curve, how difficult it was. It can't be any worse anywhere else because of the circumstances I was going through. And lo and behold, you know, I get the Hull City job, and the rest is history, as it were.
And when you take that Derby job and you start to realize things aren't smelling right, things aren't going right, how does that affect you, your preparation, and how did that affect the players in the dressing room? Because obviously Derby's been through a tumultuous period the last 18 months with all that stuff and whatever. Does what happened at boardroom level and the thing, how does that affect you and your ability to do your job? And how does that affect the players? Do you have to lift them extra in the training sessions and the games to get them going? Because they're sitting here going, hey, something's just not right here.
It's really difficult, Corey. You know, if I'm walking into a changing room and that changing room is also part of that corruption, and I'm not naming names there by any stretch of the imagination, but if by definition I picked a team and at 11 go out to represent Derby County, all well and good, you know, and I've always said this at every football club, you've got 11 that are very happy. You've got five or six that are sitting on the bench that are relatively happy, and they've got five or six sitting in the stand that are not very happy and want to do something about it, you know, either leave the club or cause a disruption or whatever going on behind the scenes, add fuel to the fire. You've got all of that going on in every football club, let alone a club like Derby County at that moment in time. But I had board members in the changing room, and it's something I always vowed when I left Derby County. If I ever became a manager again, I would not allow board members, whether it be chairman or owners or whatever, I wouldn't allow them in the changing room. That door is closed. That is the inner sanctum, and that's where we belong. I will relate everything back to you, information-wise. And if you don't trust me, don't believe in me, get rid of me. If you do trust me and believe me, which I'm your manager now, you've given me the job, this is what I want to do from a football perspective and from a business perspective. If you keep that over there and you keep this over here and I keep that, and which is the changing room I'm talking about, I keep that there, the inner sanctum. Whatever goes on in there stays in there. And unless I tell you via a board meeting or via a whatever, that's the way football clubs should be run. Directors of football on a daily basis at the training ground, watching training, talking to players, talking to individuals. And if you're not in a team, you're a good ear for them, you know? And if you're not in a team, you're a good sounding board for the player. So it's a difficult situation that I walked into. And my inexperience, obviously, I used people that I knew in the game on a daily basis, you know? I tried to get a very senior assistant manager and I wasn't afforded one. I tried to get Roy McFarland. I tried to get Colin Todd. I tried to get ex-Derby County legends to come and help me. And I wasn't afforded that. I wasn't allowed that, you know, because I think the board members, certainly the ones that got interned or detained afterwards, they weren't going to allow any of that, you know, because they would have realised, you know, that's going to block their path to the changing room. Anyway, long story short, we're dragging up a lot of old rubbish here, and it's probably music to your ears, Corey, I would imagine. But at the same time, I did everything I possibly could. I sought advice from everybody that I knew, Sam Allardyce being a main one, Peter Reid, people that I knew in the game, Bobby Saxton. These were guys that were trying to tell me that this is management, but they didn't realise how bad it was, you know. And then, obviously, in hindsight, when I got the sack, they were the first on the phone. What happened? You tell them, and then they realize, wow, that's a tough gig for anybody, as my hood is.
How did getting the sack at Derby work? Do you get, I would hope you wouldn't hear about it from the television, and obviously I don't think the internet was as widespread as what it was today. Did you get a sense a couple weeks before that your tenure finished that it was going to be kind of curtains for you at Derby, or was there a phone call, or did they just say, hey, chairman wants to see you, Phil, after training?
Well, results always dictate, and performances help you, you know, keep your job, and spirited performances more importantly. But it was a Monday morning, and I had the director of football sitting waiting in my office at Moor Farm, and he walked me around the training ground on probably three or four times, you know, so it was a long-winded conversation. He was talking about certain things that were going on at the club, and one of the things he wanted me to do, if I wanted to maintain my position as manager of the club, I would have to get rid of my backroom staff. And I thought about it long and hard, and I like loyalty, I am a loyal person. And when I was asked to do this, you know, relieve my assistant manager, my director, my chief scout, my first team coach, and I would keep my position, it just wasn't an option, in my opinion. I said, no, keep them on board and let me go. And that afternoon, I got the call, but also my my assistant manager, Dean Holdsworth, and Bob Shaw, my chief scout, also got the call. Could I have done it a different way? I don't know. But lo and behold, like I say, a week later, three board members got jail, and I felt sort of vindicated to a certain extent. Having said that, you're now out in the wilderness, you're staring at oblivion. You've been flying under the radar as an assistant manager at Bolton Wanderers all these years and serving your apprenticeship, and then you have a 7-8 month baptism of fire. You are looking at maybe the end. You're looking at the statistics of managers not going into a second chance saloon or another opportunity as a manager. It was something like 75% of young managers weren't getting a second opportunity. So I was in a, I was doing the numbers game, and I was in a bad place for a number of months. If truth be known, you know, going from fully qualified, fully educated, you know, one of the most qualified coaches in the Premier League, as well as, you know, the Championship, and now I was on the dole, as my sister would say to me, you know, you're actually claiming benefit if you don't claim benefit, of course. But that's the way it was. I was staring at that for a long time, and then I got a phone call from Adam Pearson asking me to come in at Hull City as a coach. Just get yourself back on the training ground. I've heard lots about you on the training. Get yourself back on the training ground. So I accepted it. Obviously, I had an interview with Phil Parkinson, who was manager. And I went into Hull City, but that was about, it must have been 10, 11 months I was out of work. And it was a horrible place. I wouldn't recommend it for anybody, but you've got to be strong. You've got to keep believing that the phone's going to ring. And lo and behold, in very unusual circumstances, an owner phones me up. I thought it was going to be a manager. An owner phones me up, and first thing I say is, listen, all well and good, I know it's your club, but I'll only come in if Phil Parkinson wants me to come in. He said, well, he wants to meet you. Can you, you know, and the rest history, as it were. You know, Phil interviewed me a day later and I became Hull City first team coach.
And I'm going to talk about Hull City in a minute because I've got a couple questions about that. But you mentioned before going to Derby, and I've always been curious about this, Phil, when you say you applied for the job, right? So you, did you prepare, when people apply for the positions, because normally I just assume somebody calls you like Adam Pearson and says, hey, the Hull's job available, we want you to come up or whatever. So how does it go about applying for the job? Do you have a CV and everything like that? And you just, hey, Derby sacked the manager, let's just email that or fax that into the people, get my, you know, I mean, how does that work? Is there like a super secret like job portal or something like that? How does it work?
No, you get the jungle drums beaten about George Burley, you know, like weeks before, months before. I'm talking about the internal jungle drums. And it's all well and good, but you don't actually believe it until it actually comes out there. You know, if it's flashing up on the ticker tape or Sky or on in the newspapers or however it's leaked out. But the best part of my relationship with Sam was when I upgraded my CV, which you do, you know, you carry a CV around you. It's a place of work, you know, it's what you should do. I got the pro license in 2002. So I was fully qualified to go into this position, but I just didn't have any experience apart from 5 games as a caretaker manager at Bolton Wanderers. Okay, an 80% win ratio at the time. But, you know, obviously Sam and myself took Bolton Wanderers from the Championship to the Premier League and knocking at the door of Europe. Cup competitions, got to the final of the Rumbelows Cup, and a real good success story. Survived in the Premier League all them years on probably one of the smallest budgets. All of them things were paramount importance to me in terms of my CV, but the most important one was the reference. Sam told me to put him down as a referee because he wanted to know when our relationship was going to be at its weakest. Obviously, if I'm applying for everything, all and sundry coming along, he'll know full well that the relationship was going to be very weak. Well, that's the reason why I told you I only applied for 3 jobs, and I told you exactly who got them jobs. Because I remember Sam phoning up the chairman of of Burnley, phoning up the chairman of West Bromwich Albion, and phoning up the chairman and the owner of Derby County, and nothing better than a referee than your manager at the time saying this guy's ready, give him a chance, and that's how I got the job. Jeremy Keith, I think, was the one that Sam phoned up, and they went for me.
So you take the Hull City job. Well, you come on as a first team coach, and then you ascend to the managerial position at Hull City, and you get Hull into the Premier League. What's it like as you leading a team in the Premier League for you in your career as being the boss, as being the man?
I'm trying to get away from Sam, and it's very, very difficult to get away from him, because what you've just said there just immediately brought back memories of when we beat Bristol City in the final at Wembley. Sam was out of work, and I invited him back to the hotel where we were staying to join in our celebrations. And Sam was actually on the team coach. The team coach going from Wembley to the Grove Hotel in Watford. He was sitting on the front seat with me, and it was almost surreal. It was, here's this guy that's helped me all this way along. He's now out of work, and I'm now going to the Premier League with Hull City. And it was quite a phenomenal ride. And that's all you can say. It was a ride, you know. And I brought back memories of when me and Sam were doing the, I can't think of the name of the ride or even the park, but it's the oldest roller coaster in the world. At Denmark in the gardens in Copenhagen, and we were going across. We had a strong connection with Danish players. We had four or five at Bolton Wanderers, and we were across in Copenhagen, and we were riding this this oldest wooden roller coaster, and it has a picture. And I've got this picture, and Sam's got this picture, and we'll never forget it. It's like we're on a high. We're really riding the roller coaster, but that is football. That is football. It's in its entirety. Our hands are up. We're screaming in excitement and enjoying ourselves. And then the next minute, you crash and burn. And I was on a high going to the Premier League. Sam was out of work. It's unbelievable. When we were both on the same high together, we were working as manager and assistant manager in tandem at Bolton Wanderers. And there were great journeys, fantastic journeys. But all through my career as a manager, up and down, and Sam's has been up and down, and it's quite phenomenal. That's why we love the game, though. That's why even them worst moments, them horrible moments in your life where you're out of work, you're waiting for the phone to ring, you're wondering who's your mate in the game, you've got no friends, it's stopped ringing, it's the loneliest place in the world. And then all of a sudden, next day, the phone rings and you're off and running again. It's amazing. It's absolutely fantastic.
So a couple of things I want to talk to you about with your Hull City time. First thing, Phil Brown becomes the singer of Hull. You're singing after avoiding relegation. Again, was that one of those feelings in your stomach that you felt it was just right? I mean, what happened there?
My parents have got a lot to answer for. And and this situation was definitely down to my mother. She was a singer in some of the bars and restaurants and raised a lot of money for charity, actually. Back in the day, but she always used to get me up on stage and get me one of my best mates up on stage and just try and bridge that gap, that fear. I think that's what she was trying to teach me. She would, you know, get that confidence, impregnable, you know. So you get a microphone, you have the power with the microphone. You can say what you want to say and it'll be detrimental or positive, whichever the case may be, but you've got so much control when you've got that microphone in your hand. Well, we'd survived. I'd shook Sir Alex Ferguson's hand. They beat us 1-0, fair and square. But, you know, the deal was that Newcastle had to do better than us. And they got beat off Aston Villa. So we survived. Newcastle went down. And then we came back into the changing room. And I was told by the chief of police that there had been a pitch invasion and we won't be able to do a tour around the pitch, you know, like a lap of honour, as it were. And I was, like, pleading with the guys, just clear the pitch. I mean, we owe it to them and they owe it to us. This moment is for Hull City, not for us. It's for Hull City. And he came back into the change room about 5 minutes later and he handed me a microphone and he said, the pitch is clear. So I went, I'll rephrase that. He didn't say the pitch was clear. What am I saying? Will you clear the pitch is what he said.
I don't know what that means. if you like.
Sorry, Siri's just kicked off. It's all weird and wonderful, eh? When you go back to them moments. He said, "Will you clear the pitch for me?" And he gave me the microphone. So I'm walking down the tunnel at the KSC Stadium, and I go out there, and all I can see is green. It's the grass. The pitch is clear, and I've got this microphone in my hand. And what did my mother used to say? When you got a microphone in your hand, give them a song. So lo and behold, Sloop John B started coming out of my mouth. But we joined, you know, the fans joined in, and it just became an iconic memory in everybody's lifetime to a certain extent, certainly where Hull was concerned. I had an affinity with the people of Hull. I had an affinity with them because I spent time as a manager to get to know them. And what I mean by get to know them, I had three generations of deprivation. I had three generations of grandfather, father, and son. And without being sexist, that could grandmother, you know, mother and daughter, standing on the terraces, supporting the club, and yet no fishing industry for 35, 40 years. No fishing industry. And that's all Hull was about, the fishing industry and football. So when this deprivation was about, there was doom and gloom, I felt responsible as a manager of the football club to entertain them, to reward them for standing on the terraces when they could ill afford to stand on the terraces. And it became a combination of me as an ex-supporter and now manager, and knowing full well what they're thinking and what they're seeing. And I had to sort of repay them, to be brutally honest. And surviving in the Premier League was fitting return or reward, I think, for what they had gone through in the 35, 40 years when the, you know, the 12-mile radius had been banned, or fishing, sorry, had been banned, and 12-mile radius was brought in.
Did you get stick in the dressing room from the lads when you came back in after the song?
Yeah, you do. Of course you do. But that's what I mean about the power of the microphone. People give you stick. It doesn't matter. It's gone now. That'll be remembered forever. Somebody gives you stick or grief or whatever. I didn't do it for that reason. Of course I didn't. I just did it because I wanted to be. Honestly, I would have given my right arm if the police would have allowed me to go onto the terraces with the microphone and started singing and start the chanting off at the end of the game. It would have given me great pleasure. But obviously, you've got safety issues and stuff like that, and I realise your position. But actually, I'm just a supporter. I was a supporter of Sunderland at Roker Park, and I used to love going on the terraces and getting an atmosphere going. And if that provided a platform for a player to play better, then I'm doing my job as well.
And you talked about the kind of the culture at Hull City and how you kind of built in, how you kind of the challenges that the town was facing, kind of you kind of internalized that as well. Do you feel like Hull City was the most connected you felt with the fans in your career?
No, I felt a real connection at Bolton. I had 7 years there as a player and 8 years as a coach or a manager. So I had a big connection with Bolton Wanderers sort of 15 years. And I was absolutely, you know, it's on my mind that one day I'll manage the club. But that's never came to fruition. I felt the same way Sunderland was concerned. I don't know whether it's football or whether it's people. I really haven't worked that one out yet. Which one is the more important in the answer to that question, because, you know, once you get on the same page as a supporter or a player or anybody, you know, once you get on it, you can share that understanding and that affiliation with whatever you're talking about. You know, it can be anything. And recently, since the Queen's died, I was very fortunate at Hull City that I had a lunch with the Queen to commemorate 50 years, I think it was 50 years prior to the visit. She had been in Hull and she came on the train, and it was her first visit to Hull. And 50 years down the line, I was fortunately managing the club or managing the team, and I was invited to have lunch on the same table as her. So I had a good 2 hours with the Queen. Wow, probably a highlight of my life, let alone my career. But that football allowed me to have that. Football afforded me that. And I was very fortunate to be able to do that. And I never really looked back on that with an achievement head, but that was probably a greater achievement than qualifying for Premier League football for the first time in 104 years. It's something weird, you know. And then since Queen Elizabeth died, I've sort of vowed to myself, I want to do something else. I want to do something more. And I don't mean do something else outside of football. I mean something connected with the game, but maybe, I don't know, broadcasting or maybe the media or maybe, you know, directing a football club, you know, going on a board of directors or something like that. You know, I'm vowing in my own head. I'm 63 year old. I'm not finished yet. I'm not finished yet at all. And people might think that, oh, you know, I've not heard Phil Brown anymore, you know, for a while. He's semi-retired. He's going out of the game. He's this and that. It's far from it, Corey. Far from it. I'm just sort of pulling it all together if I possibly can. And if that affords me another position somewhere, then I'll do it, you know.
Like I like to call it a strategic reset.
Possibly, yeah. The Americans have always got a great way of saying it, you know. A strategic reset. Okay, I love that.
What did you and the Queen discuss at lunch? Was she giving you like formations?
I suppose, I suppose a gentleman should never relate what they've been talking about over lunch. But I think what we focused on was football and horse racing, which was two of our passions. I had horses at the time. I had syndicates that were sharing ownership of horses, and it was something that I could really, you know, take my mind off football to a certain extent with something that I really have a passion about. So horse racing for sure. But one of the, I always remember asking one of the questions, and she afforded me an answer as well. And I think it was age related, if I remember rightly. But I was saying why she didn't do the FA Cup final anymore. You know, because I always thought the FA Cup final held its esteem because of the fact that Queen Elizabeth was at the final, or guaranteed that Queen Elizabeth was going to be at the final. And it was sort of handed down to her siblings and generations sort of beneath her. And I thought the FA Cup lost its value because of that. Nothing to do with weakened teams and Sir Alex Ferguson playing a third string Man United team, anything like that. I just thought maybe it was devalued because the Queen wasn't at the final. And I think it was probably an age thing more than anything else.
Couple more Hull questions before I talk to you about coaching and the modern game. First of all, Giovanni, I saw him play for San Jose Earthquakes after he'd left Hull, and that goal he scored against Arsenal at the Emirates still sticks in my mind. That was still incredible. What were your thoughts on that strike that night?
Giovanni was a breath of fresh air when the sun was shining. And I'm not being disrespectful there. When it was cold, it was difficult to get any Brazilian footballer, not out of bed. I mean, on a training ground, on, you know, freezing cold, Giovanni would come on snoods, fully gloved up. You know, he had hats on. You could hardly see his eyes, let alone who the player was. You know, and it was difficult to get him going. You know, but when the sun was shining, wow, what a player! And that Arsenal game was at the start of the season, so I knew I was going to get a tune out of Giovanni. But I knew there was also an opportunity during the course of that season that I was going to have to replace Giovanni with somebody else, and that was going to be the difficult part. But for the first 10 games when we were in the top three and you know, record number of points for a newly promoted club and all of these kind of things, Giovanni played a great role. We played him as we played sometimes in a diamond formation where he played the 10 behind the two number nines. But the work rate of the two number nines was of paramount importance for Giovanni, because I'm not saying he was lazy, but he looked for space. He was one of these clever players that looked for space when the opposition had the ball. You know, look for space when we had the ball, of course, you know, but when the opposition had the ball, he'd be looking for space. And a lot of people would have classed that as being lazy, but I didn't. I thought it was very clever. But if my two number nines weren't working hard enough, Giovanni was surplus to requirements. But the Arsenal game, I had a left-back called Andy Dawson playing, and Andy Dawson was getting terrorised by the winger, and I can't, for the life of it, I don't know if it was Theo Walcott. It might have been Theo Walcott, I think. Anyway, he was getting terrorised, and I needed to provide a little bit of protection for him. And lo and behold, I said to Giovanni, go and play left-hand side of midfield. Go and play left wing, basically. And I'll drop one of my number nines into the pocket of space, and he'll play the 10. There was two ways of looking at that. I could have drop me number 9 to number 11, as it were, or Giovanni. And well, Gio just did it. And I thought, well done, son. You know, one, you understand. Two, I know the sun's shining. So eventually when we get the ball, he's going to be able to hurt the opposition. But he was cutting in on his right foot, and that was the key moment. You know, he's gone to protect Andy Dawson, and then when he picked the ball up, he cut inside, and he's unleashed one with his right foot, and it's gone in the top corner. Wow. Takes me back to, was that a stroke of genius from the coach, or was it just a brilliant footballer? I think it was just a brilliant footballer himself. He was used as a protection racket first and foremost for the left back. But then I knew when Gio got the ball, they wouldn't be able to deal with him. But that's working with Gio was a challenge, if it was called. If I was in Brazil, I think Gio would be one of the best players in the world.
You know what I'm going to ask you about next, Phil? That's Manchester City away. You're 4-0 down at halftime, and I remember watching this game, and you didn't take your players in. You sat them down. I think it was on the center circle, and you gave the halftime team talk on the pitch. And I remember sitting there watching it and going, what the hell's going on here? So I'll ask you, obviously you weren't playing well because you went down 4-0. But again, was that one of your feelings in the pit of your stomach that this is just a right moment for this team to get a talking to on the pitch?
It was a bit of both. It was my background as a Sunday league player, first and foremost. That used to happen every day, you know, every game. You know, you used to get sat down on the pitch and on the halfway line and got a quarter of an orange and a cup of tea. That was it, basically. You know, that was the history of my half-time team talk. So I thought at half-time, it looked like a Sunday league performance to me from a team that was supposedly playing in the Premier League. In hindsight, you look at the wage bill and you look at the transfer money and how much Man City had on the field of play in terms of finance compared to us. They had Ronaldinho, 33 million they paid for him, and that's twice as much. One player was twice as much as my entire budget. Had a £16.5 million budget. And yet, the reason for doing it was Sunday league mentality. I had one or two players that had decided to celebrate a little bit more. The Christmas, it was a Boxing Day, the game against Man City, and they had decided to celebrate a little bit more than what they were afforded by having one or two beers more in a wrong environment that they shouldn't have been in. And I got wind of that probably about 5 minutes before kickoff, so I couldn't change the team. And I would have changed the team, if truth be known, because that was an unrecognisable first half performance. So when I decided to use all of them issues going on in my head, it was a Sunday league mentality that I wanted to get a hold of. And if it embarrassed them, it wasn't the whole team I was trying to embarrass. That was the unfortunate part. But as I always say, we are part of a team. If one makes a wrong play, then we all suffer. If one makes a right play, then we all benefit. We just talked about Giovanni making a right play, and we end up beating Arsenal at the Emirates. Two of my players made a wrong move on a Christmas day. They'll remain nameless because it's too much water going under the bridge now. But did I lose the changing room after that? No. And Corey, I can tell you that categorically. I'm an honest man, and I'll tell you that categorically. I'll state that I did not lose the changing room. Did we survive that year? Yes. What did we set out to achieve at the start of that season to survive? If we had finished 17th, if somebody had offered me 17th at the start of the season, would I have took it? Absolutely. That's what we did. And we achieved what we set out to achieve. And we had another year in the Premier League, which afforded my owners and the football club another 65 million, I think it was, in the coffers.
Yeah, not a bad return.
Not a bad return for a half-time team talk.
One more thing before we move on, Phil. How did you react to Jimmy Bullard's celebration against Manchester City several months later when he sat everybody down and he was pointing? Because I remember watching that game as well, and I thought, oh man, he's going to get it in the dressing room because you can't do your manager out like that. Were you just shaking your head? Did you know that something like that was going to go on, or did you take it in good humor?
I took it in good humor. Why did I become a footballer? Why did I want to play football? Why did I manage? The whole reason is quite simple. It's fun. I wanted to have fun. And Jimmy Bullard doing what he did, that was in the season that I'd lost my job, strangely enough. And Jimmy doing that at the Emirates, which was a year down the lane, and it was after he scored a penalty and we drew 1-1. And at the time, strangely enough, I didn't see it. I was grabbing hold of Richard Garcia just after the celebration or just after the goal. Richard Garcia was coming towards the halfway line. I grabbed a hold of him to change the formation because this was 82, 83 minutes on the clock. So I'm taking a point from being last year 5-1, humiliated, half-time team talks on the pitch, this, that, and the other, to a year down the lane, a 1-1 draw at the Emirates, the Etihad, supposedly a better team, a better pulled together team, and we're getting a point from the game. I thought it was hilarious. I really did. I went in the change room afterwards. BBC, strangely enough, pulled me just as I'm walking down the tunnel and they asked the same question. And I said, what celebration? I didn't see a celebration. You didn't see Jimmy Bullard with the players? No, I didn't see it. So I got rid of the interview, went straight to the change room, went on the laptop, found the celebration, and I just burst into laughter. I just could not believe that Jimmy, it was clearing my name to a certain extent. In the midst of all the hype and the pomp and the ceremony, the circumstance and this and the other, the humour was actually getting something off my back. You know, the weight of this half-time team talk, which was weighing heavily. Everybody asked the question and still do. How many years later? 12 years later, still asking this question. No disrespect, Corey. It's a good question, but it just sort of freed me up a wee bit. And I had to thank Jimmy Bullard for that, not to admonish him, you know?
Moving away from specific club chats now, Phil, onto more other coaching topics and things like
that. Can we do 5 minutes, Corey? I've got a bit of business on.
Not a problem. Standard of coaching, is it better today than when you started?
I think so. I think the ability of coaches these days to utilise what's available to them now compared to what was available to us in the 90s and the 2000s. I think a lot of coaches now are embracing everything, you know, whether it be sports science, whether it be the old days that used to be ProZone, whether it be, you know, football analysis, whether it be heart rate data, you know, all of these things. I think, consequently, because you're using all of these things and you're leaving no stone unturned, it takes me back to when Sam was doing it and nobody else was doing it. And we had the pleasure of that. You know, we were sort of ahead of the game. So when we were pinching a percentage off each team because we were using all this equipment, we were nicking stuff off each team and it was getting us closer to them. So we were getting to a chance of maybe drawing at Old Trafford or maybe even winning at Anfield and places like this. Now, all of a sudden, it's made it a level playing field. If coaches don't use the facilities that they've got now, they're foolish people. But I think every coach that you see nowadays, the modern-day coaches, utilising everything that's available to them to get an edge.
Talk to me about India and Hyderabad. You were there for 2 years. The Indian leagues, I wouldn't say it's new, but they're pumping a lot of money into it. I know the standard is trying to get better. What was it like managing overseas and then in a country that doesn't have necessarily the strongest footballing culture in a developing league?
It was a fabulous challenge. It was a great challenge from my perspective, meaning I was walking into a change room and I always wanted to challenge myself where this was concerned, into a change room that didn't understand your language, first and foremost. And it was a real challenge to try and improve individuals. But body language is a universal language, in my opinion. They could see when I was angry. They could see when I was intense. They could see when I was trying to get a point across. They would ask, can you explain that again? Can you? And the Indian players, the Indian boys were desperate to learn. They've got a tremendous attitude, tremendous mentality towards improving. And it can only improve with that. And I think they've slowly but surely stopped it. If the drain on resources from the original coaches, managers, players that went across there, that went there just to take the money, that was a drain on resources. And I had to get the mentality of stop paying these people copious amounts of money and give it to people who are going to give something back. And when I went there, and I'm not saying just me, when I went there, I made sure that the players that I brought in not just trained twice a day, but gave something back to the schools, to the education of the Indian players that they were working with. They just gave something back that they were getting from the Indian Federation. And with all of that, created a better environment, a better seat of learning, a better place where you can, you know, you had nothing but education coming in the way of a good attitude. It could only go one way. It could only improve. And I think it's been like that for 2 or 3 years, and I love it now that Simon Grayson's gone across there now. I think, you know, there's one or two English coaches going over there and they're being successful. British coaches, I should say. Owen Coyle's just won the title. You know, these things are good telltale signs that you're pitting your wits against some good Spanish coaches and coming out on top with the use of the Indian mentality.
And two questions, Phil, before we finish. What goes in the notebooks that these managers write in on the touchlines? Like, are they writing out their CV because it's not going to see Brendan Rodgers notoriously did? Are they writing out their grocery list? Like, what are they writing in there? And then do they go back and use whatever they've written?
I think it's just the prompters. I know what I do. I was told by psychologists when I was working as an assistant manager at Sam, no use doing 4 or 5 things at halftime. Only 3 things will go in. The mentality, the capability of a player in fatigue at halftime, and not massive fatigue, but just in fatigue because he's worked for 45 minutes. He's done his warm-up. He's done his preparation. They'll only be able to take 2 or 3 things in. So don't go any further. Make sure that you're gearing your halftime team talk to, one, you already thought long and hard about this and you're ready for it, and two, what do we need to improve to win the game if you're behind it, et cetera, et cetera. But 3 things, I wouldn't go any more than that. If you've got 5 things written down, try and get the 3 most important out of them 5.
And Phil, we obviously you're currently enjoying a little bit of a sabbatical time with your family. We talked about how, you know, you still have a passion for this game. Has the dugout's not seen the last of Phil Brown, has it? You're coming back to a dugout sometime soon.
I hope so. That strategy reset, which I like the words actually. The strategy reset is not anything different than my mindset, thinking maybe a little bit differently, thinking a little bit more about the positive needs of people. And that includes players, that includes supporters, that includes the media. Maybe taking a leaf out of one or two of the young coaches. You know, Graham Potter's now done a great job in 2 or 3 different countries. He's now got an opportunity at Chelsea, and I think that's fantastic for the English game. But maybe take a step back away from the arrogance of being a manager. Come to that level of help or support that players need and that guidance that everybody else needs. You know, I'm 63 year old. I should be long enough in the tooth to be able to get a good point of view across. So maybe just tapering my approach, not my mentality, just my approach towards the game.
Fair enough, Phil. And we'll leave it there. And I hope we can catch up again later on. But thank you so much for spending the last hour with me. I've really enjoyed it. I wish you all the best. Thanks so much for joining me.
Brilliant, Corey. Now that we've got it done, I'm glad we did. But hopefully that was good enough insight into Phil Brown.
No, that's perfect, Phil. And everybody, we'll be back next week with another episode of the Rams Review Podcast. And until then, the only last thing to say is up the Rams. Oh.
Thank you for listening to the latest episode of the Rams Review Podcast. Don't forget to like and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to get in touch, we're on Twitter at Rams Review 1. Our Facebook is Rams Review Podcast. Or you can drop us an email, ramsreview@hotmail.com. Thanks for listening, and until next time, up the Rams.